we had to incorporate aspects of feng shui in our design because that was very important in some cases. There was a lot to learn, but if you can get through some of those things, then it's a fabulous relationship. It's just incredible because they have the utmost respect for the fact that you have taken the time and that you understand aspects of their culture. They just have ultimate trust.
Welcome to Friends of Build Magazine. I'm your host, Ted Bainbridge. I've been traveling the world and working in publications for 30 years. In 2016, we launched our first issue of Build Magazine, a publication dedicated to high-end home construction, renovation, and the innovative experts that make this possible. This podcast was created to have some fun and explore those who have taken on the challenge of building luxury homes in demanding locations. From navigating logistics and construction to excavating the earth, we want to learn more about these people and how their projects became cover-worthy. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Thank you for being on Friends of Build Magazine. I'm here in North Vancouver with Risa Pollard of Beyond Beige. I have heard about this lady so much from our partner in Kelowna, Rhonda Barzilay, and you've got quite a track record. She gave me some cheat sheet notes, and right. It's fun to finally meet you.
Well, thank you, Ted. That's quite the introduction. So I will have to thank Rhonda for all the nice things that she's been spreading about me.
Oh, no, she's been bragging.
Some of them are true.
For a couple of years. There's always an element of truth the other.
That's right.
So we were commenting just before we got on air, your nails are magnificent, and apparently you won a bunch of awards, not for your nails, but for...
That's right. Yeah, we were fortunate to be finalists for 6 different categories in the Haven Housing Excellence Awards, and the event was on Saturday night at the Marriott in the Park Hotel, so it hosted about 500 people.
Okay.
Which was exciting in itself. Yeah, so that was really exciting just to have that many people in one room. And then we won actually for best custom home between 3 and 5 million.
Really?
Yeah, so that was really fun. I had taken the risk and brought my entire team. Some of them, it was their first time going to the gala.
You didn't know you were going to win?
No, of course not. Okay. No, it's actually like, they don't give you that, that little tip prior. So we all went not knowing what to expect. And there's always some twists and turns in it, and you just don't know. So
is this the old Georgies, or is the Georgies still around?
The Georgies are coming up. So these were previously the Ovation Awards. And so they changed the title of them, but the Georgies are coming up. It's coming up soon as well. Been fortunate enough to win a number of Georgies historically as well. So we are finalists in the Georgie Awards this year as well.
So I'm looking at your wall and you've got finalist, winner, finalist. I mean, do you ever take it for granted?
Well, I try to remain very grateful, not so much for the award, but for the experience that created the award. It takes sort of the right trifecta of both client and contractor and designer to come together to have everything work towards the opportunity to win an award.
Yeah, and you just said something super important, and that is you've got to have that relationship with everybody. It's
That's
a team
right.
effort,
yeah.
including the client. The client's got to give you the latitude to do what they hired you to do.
That's right. In many cases, I feel that it requires a lot of trust, and we hope to earn that trust, but in some cases, that's a very difficult component for the client. We don't have the ego to push too hard. And so if the client is really going to insist on taking it in a certain direction, we're going to concede. We're going to try to formalize that design direction and make it the best that we can, but it's not necessarily what we would have chosen for them.
So that's a difficult thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be. I have to sometimes counsel my team on what that looks like, that, there might be a strong vision in place that has come together from internal discussions and from looking at the home and the architecture and sort of what it appears to want. So we can be quite passionate about that. And then when we present it, it has a bit of a curveball, you know, aspect to it when the client comes back and says, oh, that's not at all what I was thinking of. And so we have to really start to work on the ability to collaborate and compromise and figure out what can kind of bridge that gap.
So I don't know how long the average marriage is in Canada, but in the US it's about 3 years. Yeah. And sometimes a bill takes, I mean, you're marriage counselors.
Yes, actually we have that in our contract.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we actually have a line. It actually really is helpful to see who actually reads through the entire contract. But it actually says that we are not certified counselors or marriage counselors, but we work towards creating a resolution that creates peace and harmony long after we leave.
Okay, now do most people chuckle when they read
it? They do. Okay, yeah. Good. So, and I used to say that we've never had a divorce on our hands, but I can't say that now. We've had a couple of fallouts from host builds that haven't gone well. But usually it's just a matter of really trying to take that team attitude and listening, really listening to both parties, listening to the people involved and trying to find a solution.
It really is funny. My wife and I were building our fourth house.
Right.
And we love building homes, and it's easy for us. The last house we built, which was 4,000 square feet, we had 3 change orders. Just because we make decisions and we move on, and we know it's not life or death.
That's right.
So we're doing a house in Scottsdale. We just got permits last week, and obviously prices are going through the roof. So what we thought a year and a half ago was going to be the cost, now it's significantly more. And we hired an interior designer who's a client of ours. And I looked at it just as the client. And I'm thinking, oh man, that's a lot of money. And the costs start running away from you. So you start it's not your fault. It's just what transpires. And you can just see the numbers ratcheting up, and here's another cost and another cost. When we made the decision to hire, best decision we could have made.
Right. I mean, it's a very stressful process for a lot of people. For you and your wife, it sounds like it's really fun. Yeah. And you can really enjoy that process. But for a lot of people, first of all, it's not what they do. It's not what they're familiar with. They do something else all day, and then they're trying to find time for this. It's already has a lot of stress and concern. And then you add in these really wild elements of pricing fluctuations and supply chain elements, and it can get really overwhelming really quickly. And so there is obviously a cost to having a designer, but in many cases, they don't know the stress that we are trying to manage and mitigate. Is we're really trying to take a lot of that on, and so that they can be working on making decisions that they can feel good about and that are going to that they are going to be living with, and we can do a lot of the other background working through a lot of the other aspects of it.
I want to circle back to how you started, but you're 20 years in.
Yes. Almost 19. Yeah, we're going to be celebrating 20 years next year, so that'll be exciting.
Is there going to be a party here?
Oh, yes, of course. Okay. We love parties.
All right, good. 500 people. Yeah. Yes, we love parties. What have you learned about yourself in dealing with clients that allows you to pick better clients? Because it truly is, you're interviewing them and they're interviewing you. Whereas early on, you would just take, I'm assuming, just take anybody because you wanted to get your name out there.
That's right.
And now, you want to minimize the stress on your end as much as you want to minimize it on them. So you want to make sure it's the right fit.
That's such a great point, because it took me, I feel like, a lot longer than some people to learn that. I would probably own that I was had all the energy and ambition, but was lacking the confidence to really believe that I could make that decision to hire or not, you know, like to be hired or not hired by somebody. And so I was always so grateful when somebody took me on, but I hadn't really read the signs that they were really not somebody to take on. And when you do that, you're doing it at the cost and the detriment of other clients and yourself and your team. And so I would watch it unfold, and it would really unfold exactly the way you thought it would. You know, the client could just never be made happy because they didn't go into it with the ability to be made happy. And so, I would watch like all our energy being, you know, sucked out in that direction, and it would, you know, cost me time with other clients. And so I had to really weigh in on what are the attributes of a good and not good client and be a lot more honest and forthright with myself that, and sometimes there was a real enticing aspect to it, but I had to let it go because it just wasn't ever going to have the union that I want. And when you do that, oh gosh, it's so freeing, but it also allows you to thrive with the clients and to really appreciate the clients that are really great. Like we have fabulous clients now. Like I love them. In many cases, they become lifelong friends.
Of course.
And, you know, I really have the ability to put the time and energy into them because I'm not dealing with something that's drawing all my energy out for no return.
Yeah, I just couldn't imagine. And we all go through it where we desperately want the business and we need the business.
Yeah.
But it's the worst place to be.
And I even went through that a little bit. You know, when COVID hit, I got really concerned about taking care of my staff and my team. Mm-hmm. And I took on some projects that I wouldn't have normally. And I really paid the price for that. I was reminded of it. You know, here I've been in business this long and I was reminded of it yet again. You know, we had some projects in 2021 that I knew that I just never would have taken on under other circumstances, but it was a fear-based decision. You know, and we saw it through and, you know, for the most part, it went okay because I've learned a lot of tactics to work through that. I mean, we deal with some really difficult clients. That's part of our industry. You know, I always joke that I'm a first world problem solver, and you know, and that's one of the things that we do. That is part of our business, you know, and that's okay. But that's different from a client that just like you just can't get to the end with. Like it's just they make it really difficult. So we saw that through it, and then I felt like 2022 hit and we're like, it's back, you know, the clients that we love, the projects that we love, and it's, you know, everything is back in harmony and synchronicity again.
Speaking of first world problem solver, I've got a client and I love this guy, but he was building a house and the baseboard, Raisa, in this house was $220,000.
Oh my gosh. That's a lot for baseboard.
I know. And the couple might be there a month out of the year.
Right.
So the couple is coming in. They've got the punch list, the blue tape. They're going through the house. The house is great. But they keep looking at the baseboard and they're just not feeling right. And so he's got the finished carpenter and my buddy, who's the contractor. And the husband and wife are bantering back and forth. And it's like, yeah, you know what? That just doesn't look right. They go, okay, we want you to rip it all out and try this. And he goes, my buddy says, okay, you know, it's another $220,000. He goes, yeah, no problem. Send me a bill. I'll pay it. They come back the next year, finished carpenter's there again. They don't like the baseboard, rip it out again. They did it three times. First world problems on baseboard.
On baseboard. Something that a vacuum hits, that's right. You know, or a broom.
That's right.
Those are wonderful problems to have, really. But that's the type of client that, you know, you just have to kind of, you just kind of, whatever you want, sir.
that's it. With your team. Now,
yes.
You must be a mother bear with your team, protecting them at all costs.
Yes, I absolutely am. I'm on the front lines of anything because I feel that they are not paid enough to deal with some of the things that I have to deal with, and I'm okay with that. So it allows them to feel like a layer of protection when things go wrong, that they're going to be backed and that they're going to be supported, and I'm going to take that on.
So you just won an award at the Haven Award. For $3 to $5 million.
Yes.
Which, awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That is so awesome.
Thank you.
How is it dealing with clients that are spending $3 to $5 million as opposed to when you first started out, you're probably lucky to get $1 million?
Yes. Well, you know, classically, we still work on a really broad range of projects. My philosophy is that doing just, you know, one thing is really boring. And so the spice of life is variety, right? And so I really like the opportunity to work with different price points, different types of projects. But the reality is that when you have clients that have a realistic budget and they understand numbers and they are typically, you know, in business themselves and they understand that things fluctuate and how things work, it's a much easier process. So it's not to say that the bigger budgets always are easier to work through, but the really small budgets are so challenging because, you know, everything is really just based on, you know, what's out there that works within this budget. And the clients are so much more focused on the budget that it's really hard to work through really good design. Like there's just certain elements that are difficult. So we really do appreciate not necessarily a huge budget, but a realistic budget.
Yeah, that's such a good point because I can imagine when we owned three houses in Tawas and they were all rentals because we were kids.
Yeah.
I mean, the first house we bought in 1989 was $109,000. I thought about it flying up here yesterday, and that house about 3 years ago sold for, I think it was 1.3.
Yeah. I mean, I had a similar situation. I had my home in Kitsilano and, you know, yeah, really wish I hadn't sold that one when I did. So,
you know, it's funny, you look back and I keep telling my kids, get involved in real estate, and which they are, but truly don't sell.
Right. Yeah. Just
keep
hold.
It. And, yeah. And when we moved to the States 20 years ago, I wish I kept the house and just rented it out.
Yeah.
Didn't have the foresight and nobody said, hey, knucklehead, do this.
And you couldn't ever, you know, and you couldn't have predicted this and it could have gone in a totally different direction.
I know. I look at the city.
Yeah.
It is. You're born and raised here.
Oh, I'm actually born in Montreal, but I came out.
Oh, you are?
Okay. Yeah. So, but I came out with it when I was a child. So I consider myself a Vancouverite. My parents landed here when I was 7 and I lived everywhere from Point Grey to Kerrisdale to Dunbar to Cambie Street and just kept working my way around until I finally got to North Vancouver.
Well, it's interesting because driving up Granville yesterday, and like I said, I haven't been here for 2 years.
Right.
Driving up Granville, it really hasn't changed a whole lot. And it's still magnificent, beautiful.
Yes, it is.
And Rhonda was saying, oh, there's a whole bunch of mansions. Those mansions have always been
there. Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, there's, I mean, whole areas that, you know, are kind of a subtle, I guess, in a way, because they're, you know, so secluded, but they've always been there. I mean, all of Shaughnessy has been there forever.
So this city in the 35 years that I've either lived here or been coming here has changed dramatically with the influx of Asians coming over. And now it is an incredible, like it was a nice city, but it had economic ups and downs. Now I just see it as a global city.
Yeah, I think it does have, I mean, in some respects, it's an interesting city because it's still actually, you know, kind of small, you know. I always say to, you know, to everybody, you know, like, it's only 6 degrees of separation here. You know, you're not anonymous, so, you know, make sure you don't burn any bridges because somebody's going to know somebody that's going to know you.
Yeah.
It's not that big, but it does have a much more global international feel to it now, just the way that it's, and I think it's still just the way that it's moving and where things are going with a city.
How do you deal with the personalities of different cultures when you're doing design?
That's an excellent question because it actually is much more important than probably some people are aware of. We had to pivot quite quickly because suddenly we were getting a significant number of inquiries from Asians locally and overseas, and even that has different aspects to it. So we found that we had to learn really quickly elements that would be the success or the demise of the project that would not necessarily impact another culture. So the whole contractual element of it is very different, working through that. And then we had to incorporate aspects of feng shui in our design because that was very important in some cases. So there was a lot to learn. But if you can get through some of those things, then it's a fabulous relationship. It's just incredible because they have the utmost respect for the fact that you have taken the time and that you understand aspects of their culture. They just have ultimate trust.
So as me not being a designer, my son went to Seoul, Korea for a year.
He
went as part of his university. He had to study abroad and he loves Korea. And the Korean people are incredible people.
I agree. I have one working for me.
Do?
Oh, yes. And
God, they're great people.
We love her. Yes.
Oh, they're great people.
Yes.
And
we call her our Korean dream.
Well, yeah, we want, and my son wants it too. It's like, would you please bring a Korean girl home?
Yeah.
We just think they're so polite. They're awesome.
Their hearts are just amazing.
But if you ever go over and stay at a Korean hotel, it is completely different and all the furniture is pushed to the side and it's not the warmest environment because it's their culture. How do you wrap your head around that?
In some cases, it takes understanding the why. And in other cases, it's just respecting that it's just historically, it just is, and just and working with it. And that seems to work really, really well.
We have a brain for a reason, yes. And that is to solve problems and to be open-minded enough to be able to adjust to different cultures, which, as my listeners know, I've been all over the world with my wife and my kids. We've been to 5 continents. We yeah. like change. Change is healthy. Change stimulates your brain and it gets you thinking.
That's right. Right. And exposure. I mean, for me, traveling gives me both insight on the culture, yeah. but also exposes me to architecture and design that is just so incredibly different from what we have here. And is as far as inspiration goes, to be able to draw on that and to understand it when you're working with clients here and understanding, you know, elements of design that like just aren't seen here and why they're, you know, wanting to introduce them. And sometimes like they can be sort of opposing because a certain aspect, say using the example of like Asian design, can be very formal. And Vancouver is typically very casual. And so you're trying to work through these elements that they're wanting to include. But I have an awareness because I've been there, I've seen it. I can understand what it's, you know, where it's coming from.
So when they come over here, do they embrace more of a casual environment?
Not necessarily. And okay. That's often age related. So we can really usually sense based on the age of the client, sort of the how formal or traditional they're going to be compared to embracing, you know, newer, more Western styles. You know, we've had some real surprises. The project that we actually won for, you know, they wanted something really out of the box and just really different than I was expecting. Much more like Whistler Chateau sort of look rather than aspects of with any Asian influence. So you don't necessarily know, but at least when they bring certain materials and aspects of design forward, I can at least identify with where they're coming from.
So is this one of the cooler projects that you've worked on?
Oh, we've worked on so many cool projects. And I yes, it is, because if what I love, if somebody's going to, they have an idea and it's not going to be watered down or tempered, it's going to be like, we're going to do this and we're going to go for it. And I am enlisting you to take it further. Like, what can you do that I couldn't do? I've got this idea and I'm hiring you with the expectation that you're going to make it better, take it further. And I'm like, I will always rise to that challenge.
We have a client and he's an incredible architect who does work all over the world, Swabeck in Scottsdale. And they're known to have clients that walk in and say, I have an unlimited budget and I want you to blow it.
Right. That's I'm waiting for that client. Yeah. I'll gladly take on that client.
I was going to say, do you have any of those?
I'm still waiting. Well, we are working on a project right now, which is probably there. It is a 32,000 square foot home and there hasn't really been a budget presented. So that would be as close as I've gotten this far.
Is it in Vancouver?
It is.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. With COVID, did you find that people were shrinking down the size of their homes before COVID and now they're just going, we can't travel like we used to. Let's just make a bigger home that's a playground for us right in our own environment.
Yeah, the biggest shift for us was seeing that people had so much more of an awareness of what their home could or should do for them and what how their interior was impacting them. And so they really started to recognize a space that could be better utilized or that it wasn't doing what they wanted it to do. And so we were enlisted much more to do comfort or to do purpose. So, you know, making a games room or a gym or a home office and
Cool wine cellar.
Yeah, really cool wine cellars. We did do some of those as well. Some real lounge entertainment space. You know, we did one. We was almost building a nightclub downstairs, you know, so they could just stay there and live their life as they were used to living it. So, yeah.
So take a step back. How long, you've been doing this for 19 years, almost 20.
Yeah.
Did you always know you were going to be an interior designer? Did you always know you were going to have Beyond Beige?
Oh gosh, no, not at all. Just
you
the
were
opposite.
13 years old, going, I want I want to be an interior designer.
Oh, I was 13 years old saving up my allowance for wallpaper and planning my room colors and doing all that. But, you know, I didn't even know the term interior design. I didn't know it as a thing. And certainly my parents didn't encourage it as a thing. Even years after I started doing it, when my mother was, you know, suggesting career options for me. So they just didn't see it as a career path. They were more academic. They weren't entrepreneurial. It was all very scary for them. And so I, you know, for a long time did everything but interior design. I was doing it on the side, but I was trying all sorts of ridiculous careers, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And yet on the side, I was passionately doing design. So when I finally, you know, years later went back to school for interior design, a lot of people would sort of scratch their head and be like, didn't you already do that? I had gone to UBC, but I had, you know, obviously that wasn't for interior design. That was an arts degree. So I finally went back to BCIT to do interior design. And that's really, you know, when I thought, yes, this is like, finally, this is what I should be doing. And I could recognize that a lot of people there, they could go to school for the rest of their life and they would never have that intuition as to how to create a good design. And yet for me, I had the intuition, but there's a lot of formality to design. It's not all subjective. There's a lot of rules to design. There's a lot to learn. And that was that's what I needed, was to really understand, you know, the really core concepts of design.
As I'm looking at you, you could have gone into fashion in a heartbeat.
Oh, thank you. And that was my sister. Yeah.
And so I don't know if you've seen The House of Gucci. It's an incredible movie.
Yes, yes.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, yeah, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Ted. I'll pay you later for that compliment. That's really nice way to start the day.
No, it's true. It's I look at the world that you live in and the stuff that you get to play with.
Yes.
And to walk, I mean, Raisa, the satisfaction of walking away from a home when it's completely done and you've had that ideal client that trusts you, that allowed you the liberty to do what needed to be done to meet their needs, and to walk away and just look at it, it's got to be super rewarding.
Oh, gosh. I love creating change. That's what I always think that I do. And it is, many cases, you know, it's a blank canvas and it's, you know, an evolution as to where it's going to go. And sometimes you have a very good idea of where it's going to end up, but you don't always. And so sometimes the opportunity to kind of stand back and look at the elements that, you know, are there and how they sort of evolved, because sometimes, you know, you've got hiccups that come along and things that thwart your original intentions. And yet sometimes the end result is even better than because of it. But it is really exciting. I mean, look at our design studio with all our, you know, we've got thousands of samples in there, and we have, you know, reps and suppliers come in and we get to look at all these new beautiful things. Then it just inspires you to, where can I put this? What can I do with it? And so anytime that we complete a home that we think is really successful, we feel incredibly grateful and like it was a really big accomplishment.
How do you work through getting lost or getting stumped when you're dealing with, and it doesn't have to be the 32,000 square foot house, but I know that there are times where you've got to just look and go, okay, where am I? Like, do you ever get lost?
Well, you can get off track. You know, you can kind of, you know, maybe the client is presenting things, or the contractors, you know, there's things that that need to be addressed. And so there's challenges. I really feel that sometimes it is just a matter of stepping back. We also work as a very collaborative team. And so and whether it's myself or any team member.
Now, when you say team, are you talking about your staff?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about incorporation with the contractor?
No, actually just with our staff. Okay. So we typically work on projects as a team of three. But even outside of that, sometimes there's things that come up and you actually need to bring in a staff member that isn't working on the project and just say, hey, like, this is what I'm dealing with. Like, I'm just kind of feel really stuck, and see what they bring to the table, because sometimes you just need that outside viewpoint. You know, it's a different facet and they're seeing it, you know, without all the background, and they say, well, you know, what about this? And you're like, oh, it's that aha moment where you just go, yes, that's, you know, that was the missing link. So sometimes it comes from that. Sometimes it comes from, I mean, I don't charge people, but I dream this stuff. I'm sitting eating and it's, somewhere in some part of my, I guess not frontal cortex, but wherever it is in my brain. And it just all of a sudden pops forward. And I do have those moments where I just need to set it aside. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's some inspiration that comes forward.
Oh yeah, your brain never stops.
Yeah, you know, I had a client one time that I was working at a nightclub, and he said to me afterwards, he said, you know...
Are you talking about the nightclub in the bottom of their house, the wine cellar?
No, this was actually a real nightclub. Oh, this was a Grammar Street nightclub. Yeah, okay. So you know, we worked on the project together, and it was done, and, you know, we were having a drink, and he said, you know, when I first hired you, you know, you're tiny little blonde, and you looked, and I thought you were just daydreaming, you know. And he said, and you know, all of a sudden you came back, and you know, these ideas shot out of your mouth that were just brilliant. And I thought, oh my God, like, I just gotta, you know, give her a moment. And she goes, I don't know where you went, but when you came back, you just had it all lined up as to what was going to happen. I said, well, yeah, that's how it works sometimes, right? That's not always how it works, but sometimes you just need a second to process things.
I know. I look at attorneys, trial room attorneys, and how quick they are to react to things. Much like what you just said, my brain just sometimes needs to percolate before all of a sudden, okay, now I got it figured out.
That's right.
And it might take a week, it might take a month, and at some point, your brain just keeps processing.
That's right. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Yeah, I mean, and my staff joke, because I don't have the capacity to retain anything other than design. So I'll forget, you know, I'll forget my left hand if I was given the choice, given the opportunity. But if you ask me, a color or a fabric or something, I can pretty much recite, you know, what something was from years ago and can still remember it all.
I had a builder once and he goes, you don't get passionate about what you're doing until you become an expert.
Right. Yes, that's right. That aspect of being an expert, I read the Malcolm Gladwell book, and I thought that was so interesting. I'm definitely qualified to say I'm an expert. I've put in far more than 10,000 hours into working on design. And I do sometimes really think about how the passion builds, because you have so much more to draw on. And I'm looking at things so much more like whole and three-dimensionally. Like when I'm processing a problem, there's so many factors that I'm considering. So I'm not going through one step and then realizing, oh, I hadn't really considered this properly. You know, maybe the mechanical or the electrical or the cost or the construction aspects of it. So now when I'm considering things, I've got so many more things that I'm drawing on to come to a conclusion.
How do you deal with technology? Because technology today compared to when you first started is vastly different.
Oh, and it continues to just outpace me, of course.
Well, I look at, as we're doing our house, Crestron or Lutron.
That's right.
Low voltage stuff. 100 Douglas blinds are no longer just, they're not just blinds. You mentioned the electrical room and the technology that's gone into something that was pretty stagnant for decades, and now it's completely upside down.
Yes, that's exactly. And I just accept that I have to enlist the experts for these things. I go to a lot of trade shows and try to make sure I have an awareness of what's out there. And also even make a deduction as what I feel is going to be lasting and what is going to be fleeting.
Yeah.
So that
trends.
I can, right. So that I can be recommending, doing an educated recommendation for people. But then I just really trust the people that are truly experts and defer to them and explain what the objective is, but not try to weigh in on necessarily what that looks like.
How do you know when you're leading edge, but you don't want to be trendy where this is out of fashion or out of vogue in 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, that's really been a core aspect of Beyond Beige is, you know, why we've had a lot of clients return to us is because I do spend a lot of time looking at designs coming out of Europe rather than North America, because it gives you such an indication as to where things are already actually super saturated. A lot of clients come to us and they really love an image because it's familiar to them. And it's familiar to them is because they've been peppered with it through all sorts of different, you know, looking at it on Pinterest and Instagram and all these different things. Okay. And so that familiarity is what they're drawn to. But that look might be absolutely super saturated and on its way out. And so if they're then going to follow that and it's going to be built, you know, potentially 2 years later, they're on the wrong side of that wave. So if we look at trends that are coming out of Europe or historical trends that have really endured, we have a much longer lifetime with the design elements that we're including. There's always things that are going to go in and out of fashion and people have to accept that to a degree. But if we're looking at, you know, more that 7 to 10 year life cycle and a lot of the base elements being more enduring, then we've done our job well.
I never even thought, and I hear about European designs constantly, but nobody's ever put it in such a quantifiable measure, whereas we get bombarded in North America, but the Europeans really are more refined about whether it's cabinet, whether it's leather, whether it's Gucci clothing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's more timeless, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more timeless. And definitely, you know, people don't realize that interior design is very connected to fashion and it all is now becoming, you know, more homogenous, right? Like it's all sort of blending together and they still are significantly ahead of North America. So we can actually like look into the crystal ball, so to speak, by looking at what's happening there. You know, the last time that I went, I could really see that, you know, all the darker woods, they just were non-existent. There was no dark woods. Everything was blonde and bleach. And there was even, you know, technology that
white oak.
Yeah. You know, and exactly. And technology that was allowing for things like these big oversized porcelain slabs that, you know, we hadn't even received here yet. They hadn't arrived. They were sort of in concept.
Really?
Yeah. And so, you know, that was, you know, you could really see like where things were going.
So you mentioned that you're going to go back to Spain.
Oh, yes, I hope so. Yes.
So is that business or pleasure or both?
Business. Okay. Yeah. So I'm fortunate that I love traveling and that in some cases, of course, not recently, that suppliers and manufacturers have given me the opportunity to take me to Spain or Italy or various places to look at manufacturing plants and to look at their materials there, which is fabulous.
Okay, and what do you find when you go there? Are there any special suppliers that you visit when you're over there?
I actually really love manufacturing. Okay. So I love seeing like tile manufacturing plants and countertops and even cabinets, but some of them are just so incredible. There's Porcelanosa in Spain, and I mean it's one of the biggest warehouses in the world. I mean, I think it's, you know, was featured on the show, you know, biggest structures in the world.
Seriously?
Yeah. And so it's just fascinating. And it's...
Your folks must look at you and go, where in the world did this child come from?
So, yeah. So you know, they spent, I don't know how many years just packing the ground to be able to deal with the weight. And it's all robotic. So you're walking around and there's robots that are collecting all the tile dust and they manufacture new tiles from the tile dust. So it's just an extraordinary opportunity and experience. So there's just so much to take in when you go on these tours. They're just fabulous. And they not only expose you to new products, but to new processes and new cultures. And it's just a really wonderful opportunity.
What do you find the difference when you go to Spain, Italy, and Germany?
Spain, Italy, and Germany. Well,
because they're vastly different.
They're vastly different, and I got to be careful here because I have friends in all of those places. But
well, we can't be great at everything.
Yeah,
so
that's right. You know, so I mean, the Germans, their precision, like they're so meticulous. I mean, they will show you how, you know, the hinge of a cabinet door is constructed, you know, to close perfectly and to be quiet. And, you know, I just have so much respect for like taking the time and to be doing that kind of precision manufacturing. you go to Italy and it's all about the finished product. It's just like the beauty. Like they just, everything is going to be
sexy.
Yeah. It's just everything is sexy and beautiful. Yeah. And they're so proud of everything. And Spain, you know, sort of falls in there as well. They're just, you know, a little bit more, probably a little more relaxed and, you know, there's still a lot of fun and they're just incredible hosts as well. So
I did a podcast yesterday with a gentleman, Maxim, in downtown Vancouver, and he's a Leicht cabinet company dealer. And yes. I go, what is the difference between, because he's talking about Italy and Germany, which when you said that you were traveling over there and what you'd learn, and now I want to go, and not just from our conversation, I've had a series of conversations with people, and the biggest design show in the world, I think, is in Milan.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Have you been?
Yes, I have not been.
Okay, apparently you need to.
Yes, I do need to go. Yes, I definitely do.
But what Maxim was saying is he goes, well, let me give it to you in terms of an automobile. If you've got a BMW or an Audi or a Porsche, you could let it sit in your garage for 6 months. And 6 months later, you come, you turn it on, it runs. It runs flawlessly. But it's not going to be the sexiest vehicle on the road. Now, you go to Italy and you see a Bugatti or a Ferrari or a Lamborghini. He goes, there's no guarantee it's going to turn on in 6 months. And it's no guarantee that you're going to get from A to B. But it's sexy.
That's Everybody such a great analogy. That's a perfect analogy that crosses so many sectors.
So it's not that I was trying to get you to poke the bear at all. It's just from a design standpoint.
Yes.
You know, we talk about the House of Gucci.
Yes.
Magnificent, right?
Yeah. Incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true.
So what are you excited about right now with your business?
Well, as I mentioned, 2022 has been just a really exciting year so far. We've won a number of awards, and we have the honor of working on, I believe, our best projects to date. Just really exciting for so
many
reasons.
That's got to be a blast.
Yeah, so that's just, and we have just the perfect team in place as well. So we have one member that's back from mat leave and some new team members. And I can just feel that this energy is synergy. We're just all, you know, working at the top of our game, which is just the universe bringing it all together at once, because we need to be able to work through these really exciting projects. And I think everybody feels that excitement, you know, coming off of COVID. It was wonderful. We won the National Kitchen and Bath Association Designer of the Year Award in 2021, but, you know, it was a virtual event. It was kind of like went unnoticed. And so to be.
And they're boring with no people.
You know, you know, it was just like watching on my laptop and like, oh, yay. so to be back having live events is really exciting. But I think just the projects that we're working on right now it keeps everybody really excited.
Do you ever sit back with a glass of wine and just go, you know, it is pretty cool and it's getting more fun? The clients that we're getting, we're able to pick and choose. You now have an aura or a reputation about you. So I'm assuming more people are coming to you.
Well, that's where it's really flattering. I mean, we have, you know, marketing that we do. But a huge proportion, I've been told that it's a really high proportion of the clients are repeat clients or referred clients. And I do find that incredibly flattering. And so that's where I used to work really hard, but, you know, not necessarily see that repeat client base. And now we see that a lot, and we have a lot more feedback from clients saying that that they would never go anywhere else, that they're going to refer other people and family members and friends. And so that's where it does feel really good. And that does keep you with the clients that you want, because, you know, if they're friends of these great clients, they're probably going to be great clients as well. So, so yes, to answer your question, Ted, yes, I do sit back with a glass of wine. I really enjoy doing that when I can. And so there are moments, I work a lot, and then, you know, family, my three children, keep me very busy. But if I get the opportunity, then I do like, and sometimes, you know, I sit with the staff, at the end of the day, and we'll have a drink and enjoy a moment of just talking about aspects of the day.
Well, that's so much fun. I always tell people, when it comes to marketing, there's a certain level that If you've done a good job, most of your business should come word of mouth, hands down, or repeat clients. But I always tell people there's a little company called Apple out there, and all they want to do is reinforce their brand. There's a certain expectation people have when they open an Apple box. So your marketing should be just to reinforce your brand of doing a great job over 20 years or 50 years. Or, you know, we talk about other cultures, and they take a longer term vision of, like, your German suppliers. Well, they think about things for 100 years, or Japanese think about things for 100 years. I was reading something on the plane up yesterday that I'll share with you, and it was one of the chief engineers at Toyota. They've got the, I don't know if you've ever heard this, they've got the five whys. So when something breaks, so the gasket broke, why? Well, the rings were bad, why? And they go down five because they want to get to the root cause of what the problem was.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, it solves the problem. It doesn't just deal with the symptoms, but it's always asking, okay, well, why did this happen? And they go, we're going to ask why five times.
Oh, that's a brilliant thing. My children ask why much more than five times. But,
that's because they're children.
but asking why is a great thing to do. And I think Beyond Beige, annually, we have a full day retreat with the staff.
Okay.
And we review a lot of things that went right, and we review a lot of things that went wrong. And we do ask the question, like, what happened here? How can we do better? Not with the design, but with our process, with our client interaction, with, you know, expectations. And asking, you know, the question of how can we do better, and why did something not go the way that we expected, or why was the outcome, you know, not what we were looking for, is a really important reflection.
So as you've grown, you've added more staff, obviously.
Yes.
You started as an interior designer. Now you're a businesswoman.
Yes, it's a
big difference, isn't it?
It's a big difference. It is. It's a really big difference. And I'm a businesswoman, and I'm a, you know, manager of people. Whereas,
yep.
and actually they manage me. Whereas before, I tried to manage me, but I was highly ineffective. So it's a much better way to do it. So, but it has been a really significant evolution. And for some interior designers, it does not work because they just want to be fully in control of doing their designs. And they might work always with just themselves and one other person.
Mm-hmm.
I can totally understand the aspect of the dilution when it gets too big. We've, you know, conscientiously stayed as a boutique firm.
Okay.
Sort of staff with, you know, in the range of 10 to 15 seems to be the sweet spot for us. You know, otherwise it does get to be a bigger enterprise that has a different feel to it. But there's no wrong or right to it. It's just, but it is a big difference to how my day is set up.
So do all the clients want a piece of Risa?
If you ask my staff, they would say yes. So I'm trying to, you know, here I conscientiously didn't call my business, you know, Risa Pollard Designs, thinking that I could be, you know, stand back and, you know, I had, you know, aspirations of standing back and having a team in place and I would be anonymous, and that I haven't got there yet. So I do tend to want to have a touch point with each and every client and assure them that I don't need to be on the front lines of everything.
Okay.
My staff is more than capable of all the work that needs to be done. But I know what my strength is. My strength is as a real creative and a problem solver. And so I can typically add that last little element that, you know, or I can push my staff to, like, how do we just make it that much better? Like, what last layer can we add to this to just really set it apart? Like, this is good. It covers it ticks all the boxes, but we want to add that extra, you know, we want to tick that extra box of something that is standout, is unique. Like, when we stand back, is this just a little bit too obvious? And we want to just throw something into the mix. So that's, what I can bring to the table, as well as in many cases the history of construction knowledge, to really make sure that what we're attempting to do has all the practical considerations addressed as well.
So I know my personality, and I know what we're building, which falls into the price range of what you just won the award. And if I was dealing with your firm, I would want you.
Right.
How do you manage your clients? Because there's only so much of you to go around, but your clients, most of the, if they're dealing in a $5 million home, they're a type A personality who's a driver who wants answers now.
Yes.
Whether it's the wife or the husband, it doesn't really matter. And most of the time I find, like my wife, she makes all the decisions. I've got an opinion.
Yes.
But if she's not happy, it's not going anywhere.
That's right. Yes.
So how do you manage that?
Well, I tell them that if they want quick answers and they want to have communication, that I am the wrong person. So so they start to realize that.
So
that
this is your disclosure statement when you're sitting down interviewing each other. Yeah,
that's right. You know, that I am not the one that's going to answer the email or the text the fastest, that if they want the process to go the way that it should, that they're going to have a much faster response from my team.
Okay.
And so I touch down, in meetings, and I assure them that, that I have given consideration to the project, which I, love to do. I really love to be making sure that the project is going to have that Beyond Beige element to it. And now I think if you manage their expectations right from the beginning as to what this is going to look like and be really honest about what we know to be the best process, then they accept that. And then it works really well.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
In 5 years, I hope that I will be building my own home with my own, doing my own project. So I've got that semi in the
You want to be the general contractor?
I'm not the general contractor.
Oh, okay.
No, but I haven't actually built myself. And so
fun.
Yeah, and I would love to do that. So I have a property that I have subdivided, but I live in it and I need to tear it down. So I've got a little bit of work to do. But that's an exciting project. I'm really looking forward to that. So I'm hoping that in 5 years I will have that well off the ground, and that I think that I would like to see Beyond Beige continue to push the boundaries of that sort of that glass ceiling as to where we're working. I'd like to do more projects out of the country. I have a place in Palm Springs. I love mid-century modern design. So looking at projects that are sort of niche, interesting projects is really exciting to me. And yeah, I think that it's just it's really difficult to stay relevant in this industry for this long. And so just that alone is an accomplishment, to be staying up, in the mix with some of the really fabulous designers that do exist. They're incredible. I have great respect for my peers. And so to stay in that mix is an accomplishment.
Well, as long as you're always willing to learn and push yourself,
yeah,
I think that's the key to staying relevant.
Yeah, I love this. I love this industry because you just never stop learning, never. And I tell that to my staff when they sometimes get down on themselves, like, "Oh, how did I not know that?" And I said, "There'll be things that you're learning, because that's the most exciting part of this job, is that it's just endless learning."
So when you do your house, I'll be interested to talk to you when it's done to see you as your own client, what perspective changed compared to you as working with other clients?
That's right. Yeah. So I've done numerous renovations and, been on both sides of that. So that has been an interesting experience. And so the new build will be the next one.
Okay. Have you done any TV shows?
Not my own TV show. No.
Okay.
Yes. I've been in front of the camera for various things. And years and years ago, I did get asked to try out for a Love It or List It.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. And I didn't get it. And I'm quite grateful that I didn't, because, upon seeing it, it's a dramatic enactment of design. It's not really, it doesn't really correlate to reality very much.
No, I know. But they got to make it for TV.
That's
so
right. Yeah,
they got to have.
Right. Yeah, and it's great. It's great for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, I know several people who deal with the Property Brothers.
Right,
And those guys, they're fabulous guys, but what you see on TV, it might have taken 10 minutes, because they just come in for the glamour shot and then...
You know, and that's been an interesting aspect to our industry, because people love watching these shows.
Of course.
They, you know, they reference them. And so for some clients, you know, they have a really hard time understanding why something can't happen in 3 weeks, and, you know, why the budget isn't, you know, they're missing certain aspects of the, you know, the budget to get it complete. So it throws a different spin into what we're having to explain to a client when they're coming from the aspect of looking at too many design shows.
As we wrap up, what are you most proud of?
What am I most proud of? I'm most proud of the team that I have created, Beyond Beige, staying relevant for 20 years, and for being, you know, a woman with three children and feeling like I am raising three happy, healthy children while I'm raising a business at the same time. So it's a juggling act that is, you know, endlessly entertaining, I'll say, and but it creates for a real dynamic and exciting life.
Well, that's a great answer, and there truly are no shortcuts in life.
Yeah,
and why would you want to take any?
That's
anyway?
Right. So you just gotta jump in with 2 feet and go all in.
Raisa, thanks for taking an hour to talk with us.
It was lovely.
I have enjoyed it.
Yeah, no,
it's so nice. Until next time, I'm Ted Bainbridge. Thanks for joining us on Friends of Build Magazine. Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. You can find everything discussed in this episode and more in our show notes below. I'm Ted Bainbridge, and you've been listening to Friends of Build Magazine podcast.